Hi, I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor for The World. I'm not as familiar a voice as Marco or Carolyn, but I'm no stranger to The World. I was part of the early team that launched the program back in 1996. And if you're a longtime listener of The World, you would have heard me reporting from South Asia during the earlier years of the show. It's great to be back leading such a committed team. And it's an honor to share this work and these stories with you, our listeners. We are able to produce the best in international reporting with the highest production value because of listeners like you who stepped up to support The World financially. Right now, it's a critical time for our nonprofit newsroom, as the funds from this drive help power our reporting year-round. We are coming to the end of our drive, and our goal is to raise $67,000 before December 31st. Can we count on you to meet that goal? Please visit theworld.org/give to donate today and have your donation matched. That's theworld.org/give. And thank you from the whole team here at The World.
It's a time of year when thoughts turn toward the sacred. What that means varies a lot from person to person.
The wind is actually teaching us the meaning of life.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today on The World, we look at how people experience transcendence across the globe, whether it's finding peace inside the barrel of a wave or dancing in a Berlin nightclub.
I couldn't believe myself. Like, it was kind of like an enlightenment.
In Chile, there can be enlightenment in an indigenous form of hockey.
A mí me pasa como algo mágico. A mí me cuesta correr, soy como pesada.
Where this player says her ancestors help her run.
How sacred spaces connect us to a higher sense of purpose. That is on this special edition of The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. It is good to have you with us. As the year comes to a close, the moment of looking back and taking stock is common in many cultures, a time for reflection.
This year, we have been on the lookout for places across the globe where people go to reflect. We've been thinking of them as sacred spaces. Some are places of worship, others are out in nature, some aren't even physical places at all.
Today, we're going to step into some of these sacred spaces. We begin in the South Pacific on the tropical island of Bougainville. It's officially part of Papua New Guinea. Its people are devoutly Catholic. The World's Patrick Wynn made his way to this lush green place where he heard about an icon of St. Mary believed to have spiritual powers.
The ladies see me coming. They're huddled in the eave of their wooden shrine, staying out of the rain. They wave me into the little structure painted eggshell white.
Hello.
Hello, Tampara.
Tampara is a greeting in the local language. I've come just in time to see Marina, the shrine's caretaker, saying the Hail Mary.
Ave Maria, you pull up long gracia, Lord is top long you.
That's Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with you, in Tok Pisin, an English-based Creole that's spoken here.
Mama belong God, pray belong help you, Mipla.
56-year-old Marina Kuresu, barefoot in her bright green dress, is the person in charge here. You can just tell. Her brown eyes shine with authority. She's got a story to share about a foot-tall wooden statue of Mother Mary, the icon for which this shrine was built. It rests in an alcove built into the wall behind her. But she's not ready to show it off just yet.
We are not just praying to the statue or whatever the wood, but we feel the presence of Mother with us while we are praying here in this shrine.
Marina tells me there was once a missionary priest from Europe who lived in a small house nearby. He's the one who brought the statue.
He brought it from Italy.
Long time ago.
Yes, early 70s, when we were still little children.
In the early 90s, everything changed. There was an uprising here for independence, which turned into a full-blown war with Papua New Guinean troops. Marina, like most villagers, fled to live in the jungle. As for that priest, by the time locals dared to come check on him in 1994, his house was nothing but a heap of ash.
The house was burnt down. We don't know who burnt it, actually, but underneath the ash was the statue. It was underneath.
Every other bit of the house was burnt to cinder, she says, except for the statue of Mary. Locals hailed it as a miracle.
What happened? Our miracles was really based on our prayers.
Simon Korajkove is another survivor of the war, which lasted until the early 2000s. He's also a former top official in the Roman Catholic Diocese of Bougainville, the island's connection to the Vatican.
When Christianity came into Bougainville, it really fitted well with our culture. We have the system where the mothers or a woman are the head of the land.
On this island, women hold great power. They call the shots within their matrilineal clans. Korajkove says that's why Bougainvillians are so drawn to Mary, a divine female guardian. Inside the shrine, Marina Kuresu tells me that during the uprising, while hiding in the jungle, Bougainvillians prayed to Mary constantly. She says when they found that statue somehow unharmed, that vindicated Mary's powers.
When we look at the statue, we experience that the real presence of Mother Mary is here. Even though it was bent, we can still feel the presence. It's extraordinary.
With her story complete, Marina finally leads me over to the statue. The icon is made of dark wood, mahogany maybe. Mary is hooded, her head bowed, hair flowing over her shoulders. The woodcarver, whoever they were, painstakingly etched folds into her robes. As promised, the statue looks completely unsinged.
Even though it was made of wood, you just imagine it. It wasn't bent.
Do you think that God protected the statue?
Yes. It's God's plan that the statue is still surviving.
As for what Marina prays for, she says it's what almost all Bougainvillians have prayed for a long time, an independent country of their own.
If people are close to Mother Mary and Jesus, then maybe independence will be brought about.
Bougainville's leaders expect to peacefully break free from Papua New Guinea and start the world's newest country by 2027. For the World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bougainville.
In Argentina, soccer isn't quite a religion, but it comes close. In a country beset by inflation and rising poverty, soccer is one thing that can bring everyone together. It doesn't hurt either that Argentina is a reigning World Cup champion. Reporter Lautaro Grinspan takes us to the country's most venerated soccer stadium in a working-class neighborhood of Buenos Aires.
On game days, supporters of the local soccer team, Boca Juniors, take over the streets wearing yellow and dark blue. Andres Escobar drove 250 miles to be part of the gathering. This is the party, he says. This is part of the folklore of Boca. They rally in the streets for hours, and then the fans will head toward the team's home stadium, which is also one of Buenos Aires' most iconic monuments. It's called La Bombonera. Painted blue and yellow, the Bombonera isn't modern or glitzy. It's not even the city's biggest stadium. But this 84-year-old structure has built a legacy as the liveliest place to watch soccer. Its unique architecture has something to do with it. The stands are dizzyingly steep, which allows fans to pack in close to the action. In Argentina, many people say soccer is the country's national religion. If that were true, then the Bombonera would be its holy see. It helps that the stadium was for a long time the professional home of soccer legend Diego Maradona. Maradona passed in 2020, but there are shrines in his honor across the country. In adjacent balconies facing the Bombonera, a life-sized replica of the revered soccer star stands next to that of another famous Argentine, Pope Francis. Pablo Lisotto covers Boca Juniors for Argentina's biggest newspaper, La Nación.
Es de alguna manera una experiencia religiosa.
Attending a game at the Bombonera makes for a near religious experience, he says. Fans get so excited, jumping and cheering, that they make the stands feel like they are shaking. Tickets can be very expensive.
Pero vale la pena cada centavo.
But it's worth every cent, he says. Perhaps no one embodies the devotion of the fans inside the Bombonera better than Carlos Arnaiz. A 72-year-old accountant, Arnaiz first watched a Boca game in the stadium in 1968. Since then, he has missed just a couple of the more than 1,000 games that have been held at the Bombonera.
Yo digo que la misa del domingo.
It's like Sunday Mass, he says. The Bombonera is a mystical place. It's a temple. To miss a Boca game, for me, it's sacrilegious. It's a stain on my resume as a fan. During games, Arnaiz doesn't just sit back and watch. Instead, he belts out Pro Boca chants. His singing has earned him a nickname, the tenor of the Bombonera.
¿Cómo no voy a ser? ¿Cómo no voy a ser hincha de Boca, vago y atorrante?
Outside the Bombonera, Boca fans said that love for their team transcends class, politics, and generations.
Se mezcla, acá no hay diferencia. Acá todos ven la misma camiseta, la misma remera. Todos somos azul y amarillo acá.
We don't treat people differently here, Boca fan Manuel Alfaro said. We all have the same jersey. We're all blue and yellow. Whenever he gets to witness a win in the stadium, Alfaro says he feels like he's floating for at least a week afterward. Arnaiz, the tenor of the Bombonera, says he feels drained, happy but drained.
Muy fuerte todo lo que se vive, fuerte.
The emotions are too intense, he says.
¿Cómo no voy a ser si soy de Boca y tengo aguante?
Wow.
For the world, I'm Lautaro Greenspan, Buenos Aires, Argentina.
Right next door to Argentina, in Chile, the Mapuche people are reclaiming their indigenous heritage after a long, painful history of discrimination. In part, that means reconnecting to their ancestors via an ancient sport. Michael Fox takes us to the Chilean capital, Santiago, for that story.
It's a warm spring Sunday morning. A few dozen people congregate in a park. They've brought food and drinks to share, and they have two things in common. They are all indigenous Mapuche who live in Santiago, and they are here to play palín. Palín is like the Mapuche version of field hockey, played with a hard wooden ball, though here they're using a tennis ball to keep it safe. They say their ancestors have played it for thousands of years, and one of the things that really stands out here, almost everyone plays. On the field, there are men, women, little girls, and grandparents like 55-year-old Oriana Castro.
Bien, bien, porque nosotros estamos viviendo nuestro juego ancestral.
It feels so good to play, she says, because we're living our ancestral game. We Mapuches are ambassadors of our own culture. And it's beautiful because they didn't teach us this as a child. This is something beautiful that we are experiencing now. 35-year-old Javier Soto Antigual is the coach and leader of these weekend games in the Santiago neighborhood of Pedro Aguirre Cerda.
Hay mucha población mapuche, ¿ya? Y la gente mapuche de aquí vive no como mapuche, vive como...
He says there's a large Mapuche community here, and with the help of the Mapuche organization Wenewen, or New Force, they've been holding these community games here for 3 or 4 years. There are some key differences between hockey and palín. You still try and score on the other team by knocking the palí, or ball, over the goal line on the other side. But the teams don't line up on each end of the field. Instead, they line up long ways. And each player is matched with someone on the opposing side to be their contrincante, or con. You can think of this as man-on-man defense, but it's much more than that. Soto Antigual explains that you play against your con, but you're also connected to him or her.
Si tú juegas y el otro está débil, tú tienes que ayudarlo a que esté despierto.
So it means that if you're playing and your con is tired or weak, you have to help them wake up, says Soto Antigual. If they get hurt and can't play, you have to leave the field too. So it creates this rivalry, but also friendship. But it is not just a sport. Guillermina Rojas is 55 years old. She wears a shirt with the colors of the Mapuche flag, blue, green, red, and yellow. She's only been playing for 2 years, but it has changed her life.
A mí me pasa como algo mágico. Yo, a mí me cuesta correr, soy como pesada de cuerpo.
It's like magic, she says. It's hard for me to run. I'm heavy set. But I feel like when I'm on the field, it's not me who's running, it's my ancestors, she says. My Mapuche ancestors.
De donde, del pueblo que yo pertenezco, que yo soy Mapuche.
As Rojas speaks, tears run down her cheeks. She says she plays barefoot because it's her connection to Mother Earth. And when she holds the huiño, or wooden stick, she also feels her connection to the natural world. Palin is important, she says, because this is the way that we're able to continue our culture. We practice it, and it's not just about sport. It's about our spirituality that fills us and gives us the strength to continue. The game ends, and everyone on the field runs in to hold a final ceremonial chant. Coach Soto Antigual says it was a great game. They lift their sticks high and beat them together. Not just one side, but everyone on the field, united together. For The World, I'm Michael Fox, Santiago, Chile.
Hi, I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor for The World. I don't often have the opportunity to step behind a mic these days, so I want to take this chance to extend a few heartfelt thank yous and ask for help. First, a sincere thank you to all of our listeners. You are the thread that runs through our reporting. It's always an honor to share this work and these stories with you. We hope that after listening to our program, you have a better, more empathetic, and nuanced understanding of the world and our global community. To our team, thank you. I'm proud of your work and grateful for your integrity, passion, and of course, the excellent journalism you produce. And finally, our listener members who generously support our programming, thanks for being with the world. As a nonprofit newsroom, we rely on your support to keep doing this vital work. Right now, we could really use your help. We are quickly approaching the end of the year, and time is running out to reach our goal of $67,000 by December 31st. If you've never given before, perhaps today is the day. A generous donor has offered to match every donation dollar for dollar, doubling your impact. If you've donated in the past, consider renewing your gift or increasing your monthly contribution, if only by a small increment. This drive is critically important in sustaining our reporting year-round, and every gift gets us closer to our goal. I know we can count on you. Please visit theworld.org/give to double your impact today. That's theworld.org/give. And thank you from all of us at The World.
Wherever wind and water meet to make a wave, surfers are sure to follow. Like on this beach in San Diego. Making the most of a fleeting moment in nature can be a sacred experience. Someone who's given a lot of thought to the meaning of catching waves is Karma Lekche Tsomo. She's a Buddhist nun who grew up surfing in Malibu, California, and is today a professor emerita of theology and religious studies at the University of San Diego. We're actually together today at Tourmaline Surfing Beach in San Diego, a great place with gentle knee-to-chest high waves, though today it's not looking great, just a few people out in the water. And obviously not us. Karma, did you ever look at the water and judge the waves, or do you try not to let it matter? Is that the point for you?
I mostly enjoy the waves. I enjoy the atmosphere. I enjoy the whole experience of being free, being solitary, having a new perspective on the world that we don't normally get when we're on the beach, because your world is turned around. And so it's a magical, unique experience.
Do you remember the first time when surfing really excited you in a way that made you think, huh, this is more than a sport, this is more than exercise, there's something else going on here? And what was that moment and what happened?
Well, I had a life-changing experience when my brother and I almost died at sea. I was 11, he was 10. We were very strong swimmers. It was our first summer in Malibu, and we were still mat surfing. We lost our mats on the first wave in a storm warning, which we weren't aware of, and we were stuck out at sea for about 2 hours until we turned blue. We'd made our peace with each other. We tried clinging to kelp beds. We'd
tried to flag down fishing boats unsuccessfully, and we were really prepared to meet our maker.
That's intense.
That was very intense. And somehow someone from the shore had seen us and called our mother, who then freaked out and called the Coast Guard, who eventually came and rescued us. So that moment brought us very close to death. And I really, even at 11, had a life flash. So I think that that moment completely transformed my understanding of life and death, even at such a young age. And very shortly thereafter, I got in touch with Buddhism because our family name was Zen, spelled Z-E-N-N, a misspelling of a German name. But because of that name, the kids at school used to call us some kind of Zen Buddhist. And that led me to the public library and two books on Zen. And the rest is history. I just took it and ran with it. So for me, surfing is a spiritual experience to the extent that it makes us turn inward instead of always concerned with the trivia of life, the mundane facts of existence that are so entrapping and boring. Instead, we look at what's really important in life, including the meaning of life, moment to moment.
Encountering the simple beauty of a wave, riding it as long as you can until it's over, does that make sense to you in a kind of Buddhist lens?
Absolutely. You know, the wind is almost a metaphor for impermanence because the wind is always changing. We can refer to the wind as a metaphor for life because our lives are always changing. And do we really show up? You know, most of the time we're checked out, like the mechanical man of Gurdjieff. We miss the moments. And so life goes by, and before we know it, we're dead. We blew it. We weren't tuned in. So in a way, surfing, because your life is on the line, especially if you ride big waves, which, I mean, you know, 10 foot, you can still...
Do you ride 10 foot and above?
Well, yeah, in Malibu. I mean, they're sweet little waves, but they're 10-foot waves,
yeah.
And I have scars to prove it. Yeah, we were like samurai, you know. We'd just like walk out over the rocks and blood dripping from our shins, and we're like, you know, impervious, immortal. And so the wind is actually teaching us the meaning of life, that the moments are going by, and if we're not tuned in, we're utterly blowing it. And so this, for me, is one of the important, central, crucial things I learned from surfing since childhood. And I try to carry that with me because, well, you know, from a Buddhist point of view, it's not the only chance we get. This is just one lifetime among infinite lifetimes. But it's an important one because we have the potential to completely realize, to wake up. But it's up to us to take the opportunity.
How do you look for meaning in the natural world? Like, what are you keeping an eye out for when you're not in the waves?
Well, I've lived in the country most of my life. When I grew up, Malibu was country. Then I lived up in the Himalayas in Dharamsala for 15 years. So you're in touch with the birds and the insects and the animals and all of the plants that give life to us all. And we appreciate them. And then there's the furry doggies as well. I mean, you know, I mean...
Like the one that just passes by.
The one that just passed by us, so cute, yeah. And so we learn from all of them. Of course, from a Buddhist point of view, we want to protect life. Because, I mean, their life is as precious to them as ours is to us. And what right do we have to deprive them of their precious opportunity? And anyway, they all serve a purpose, and that's what we're learning with the environmental crisis as it is. Mm. We've messed with the environment, and look at the results. It's a disaster. And so we try to, you know, nurture the earth and preserve it and appreciate it. It's really a wonderful world, despite all the hazards and crazy that's going on.
So we began talking about the conditions today. I mean, there are good wave days or parts of a day. Then there are just days when there's no surf. It's just flat. I mean, I kind of think it's a metaphor for life generally. And I'm wondering if you have kind of a a mantra or something you tell yourself in those moments where it just doesn't look good?
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, we all face those days. That you can't have excellent ways every day. It's unrealistic. But what we can do is generate loving kindness for all living beings all the time. That's something that's an equal opportunity endeavor. So whenever we feel down, we can just look inside and generate from our heart loving kindness for our loved ones and also for our enemies. Not only that, but even for all those billions of people we don't even know. And what it does is to create a place of happiness in our hearts that we can share with others. So they say, you know, all happiness depends on serving others. All misery derives from thinking of oneself. Mm. Mm.
That was Karma Lecce Somo, a Buddhist nun who grew up surfing in Malibu. She's a professor emerita of theology and religious studies at the University of San Diego. We met up on Tourmaline Beach in San Diego, just one of the sacred spaces we're taking you in today's episode of the show.
People find spiritual meaning in all kinds of places, from large cathedrals to homemade shrines. For some, an old-fashioned phone provides a connection to the afterlife.
I dialed my son's number as if he was actually about to receive the phone call, and I just talked to him.
More sacred spaces ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today we're visiting a number of sacred spaces around the world where people connect to something bigger than themselves.
Our next stop is Istanbul, where on the first day of every month, thousands of visitors from many different faiths gather at a Greek Orthodox church in the Old City to make a wish. The church is built over a natural spring that Orthodox Christians consider sacred. This summer, the world's Duri Buscarin went to see what happens during this monthly ritual.
Even though it's a weekday, the line curls through the church courtyard and down the block.
You have dreams? I have dreams.
With a big smile, a Ukrainian woman named Elena opens a bag of chocolate candy and passes it around. This is the rule. If your wish comes true, you come back with sweets to share. She can't tell you what she wished, but whatever it was, you can tell it was big.
It's only for me. It's secret. It's only for me.
The Church of the Dormition of the Mother of God is in one of Istanbul's oldest neighborhoods. It's affectionately known as the First of the Month Church. The wishers often stand in line for more than an hour to take a small metal key. As they pass through the church, many use the key to tap on glass images of Greek Orthodox icons displayed along the walls. Some take a moment to do a confession or receive a blessing from a priest. Then they descend a stone staircase to the basement, where a line of faucets are connected to a natural spring below the church. As the line passes by, some dip their hands underneath it to have a drink or wash their face. Others gather it in a small bottle for later.
None of my wishes has come true.
Senya from Belarus asks not to use her last name due to the political situation there. She's here with a friend who's had more success. 3 out of 7 of her wishes have come true.
Well, mostly about job and salary and career and something like that.
Next to them is Semra Atay from Istanbul. She's here on behalf of her brother, who wished last month that his application at an Italian university would be accepted.
And in 3 days, it happened, and I just returned the key and make new wishes.
When your wish comes true and you return the key, it gets reused, passing that good luck on to the next person with a wish. No one is fully sure how the practice began. The original Eastern Roman church that stood on this ground was destroyed during the Fourth Crusade and became a garden during Ottoman times.
It was rediscovered along with an icon of the Dormition of the Virgin Mary.
Father Hieronymus Sotirelis is a deacon of the Ecumenical Patriarchate, which oversees Greek Orthodox churches in Istanbul. In the 18th century, the story goes, a young girl had a dream that there was holy water here. After some digging, local Christians found the spring.
It's not a wishing well. These miracles could range from, you know, the healing of someone from cancer. Women who could not bear children have drank from the waters and are able to conceive.
Sotirelli says many Greek Orthodox churches are built over natural springs. You need the water for services, for baptisms, but it's also a central part of how he sees the faith.
It's just something that exists, and then we sanctify it in a way, which is the understanding of our interaction, if you will, with the physical world of the Orthodox Church in many ways. We always present our creation, but also the natural creation to God, and he sanctifies that and gives it back to us.
Almost all world religions incorporate water. And he says, if you look at the line at the first of the month church, there's a diversity there that he sees as a beautiful thing. After passing through the church, wishers exit through a courtyard garden. Some sit at picnic tables under the trees.
I was kind of going through a rough time in my life.
Nilgün Eke says she first came to the church 10 years ago when her friend introduced her to the idea.
I was like, okay, I'm so desperate, I can do that.
Eke lives in the San Francisco Bay Area, but she grew up here in the old part of Istanbul. She says she's not particularly religious, but coming to the first of the month church reminds her of the Istanbul she grew up in.
I had Jewish friends and Christian friends. My sister-in-law was Armenian. So we used to join ceremonies and services. And that reminded me of that colors and beauties of Istanbul.
Today, she floats through the garden in a blue sundress, passing out powdered cubes of sweet Turkish delight. That means, this time, her wish came true. For the world, I'm Derry Buscarin, Istanbul.
Churches, temples, synagogues, they are often considered sacred spaces. For many of us, though, we can be transported to a sacred space wherever we are through music. In a moment, we'll look at how the club scene in Berlin can be a religious experience for some folks. But first, we head back to Argentina, where a group of people are on a mission to revive music beloved in the Jewish culture. This song is one example. It was composed by a Jewish Argentine musician back in the mid-20th century, but almost lost to history. Natalia Kosoy sent us this story in the fall from Buenos Aires.
Jasmine Garfunkel and Federico Garber are working together in their flat to revive melodies that haven't been heard in decades. Jewish songs written in Argentina, but nearly forgotten.
I try to figure out, for example, which tempo is the best one that could fit the character and which is the character of the song.
The challenge is how to turn sound into music.
Garfunkel, a singer, and Garber, a pianist, are a couple, both in music and in life. Together, they are recording pieces of Jewish music from Argentina's past, songs never previously recorded or whose recordings have been lost.
The fact that I could sing Yiddish songs which haven't been recorded before is fascinating for me.
They sit side by side at the piano, surrounded by sheet music. Garfunkel leans over, pointing out the notes as Garber's fingers run gently over the keys. The song they're rehearsing right now is one of many they've found thanks to a collaboration with musicologist Silvia Glossa. For over 20 years, Glossa has dedicated herself to uncovering these lost treasures. Sheet music hidden away in archives or kept by the relatives of the composers.
Y lo más hermoso que nos aparece en estas búsquedas como musicólogas es cuando aparecen las partituras.
The most beautiful thing we come across in our research as musicologists is when we find the sheet music, she says, whether in print or handwritten. Glosser's and Garfunkel's project is called Para que los archivos suenen, to make the archives sing.
Las partituras escritas no dicen nada, o dicen poco, o dicen, no dicen todo.
The written sheet music doesn't say much, or it says very little. So these songs have to come alive again, says Glosser. musicians do not have any reference to decide how to play the songs, so they have to make their own way through the printed paper, making decisions on tone, character, and arrangement. This project is not only about preserving a musical heritage, but also about keeping alive the stories, the emotions and the voices of a generation nearly lost to history. These are songs written by Jewish immigrants to Argentina in the 20th century, often in Yiddish, immigrants who escaped violence and discrimination in Europe to build a new life in South America. One remarkable discovery is a Vidalita.
Hay una vidalita que me parece un conjunto de cosas, de mundos que se tocan.
There is a vidalita that, for me, combines many worlds, says Glosser. The Jewish world with Yiddish lyrics and the Argentine world, as the vidalita is a musical genre specific to this country. This is the voice of Judith Elkes singing Zamele, written by her grandfather, Bernardo Falla.
La canción es de un chico durante la guerra.
The song is about a boy during the war who tells the names of his mother, father, sister, and brother, and what happened to them. And their end was death, says Elkes. Bernardo Falla, Elkes' grandfather, was a composer and choir director whose work is being recorded as part of the project. This is one of the compositions. It's called Unter deine weiße Stern, Under Your White Stars, based on a raw and heartbreaking poem Avram Sutkeva wrote during his days in the Vilna ghetto.
Unter deine weiße Stern streck zu mir dein weiße Hand, meine Wörter seinen Tränen
For Elkes, listening to this song is a deeply emotional experience.
La escuché grabada y se la mandé también a mi mamá. A mí me resultó fuertísimo.
I listened to the recording and I also sent it to my mom, Elkes says. It was incredibly powerful for me, incredibly powerful. Jasmine's version is so sweet.
No veo nada, la letra y no la sé bien. Mira lo que es esto.
Back in Garfunkel's and Garber's apartment, the couple continues rehearsing. As Garfunkel sings, her voice carries not just the notes, but the weight of memory and identity. For the world, I'm Natalio Cosoy, Buenos Aires.
You're listening to a special episode of The World, all about sacred spaces. This program is part of our Sacred Nation project, funded by the Henry Luce Foundation. Find more Sacred Nation stories and images on our website, theworld.org.
Clubbing in Berlin has been big for a long time.
Willkommen, bienvenue, welcome.
The musical Cabaret showed life at the Kit Kat Club as the Nazis were rising to power. Fast forward to the 1980s.
Now's the time on Sprocket for me, dog!
On SNL, Mike Myers spoofed disaffected young Germans who go to clubs to, let's say, express themselves on the dance floor.
It's safe to say that historically people experienced transcendence in Berlin's nightclubs, but the club scene today is under threat from rising property values in a gentrifying city. When the world's Sarah Birnbaum first reported this story back in 2020, one group of clubbers was trying to save the scene with a law that would, in a way, recognize clubs as sacred spaces.
Daniel Plotch fell in love with techno music as a teenager in the 90s. He says he used to hang out at the legendary Club Tresor, which was in the cellar of an old department store where the bank vault used to be. The dance floor was sandwiched between bank safes.
I just went down in there, like I got goosebumps. I couldn't believe myself. Like it was kind of like an enlightenment, just, you know, in this like old bank vault. And then this like ramming bass and kick drum and the hi-hat. And you're just like, you know, you're losing it.
Daniel wanted to bring this religious experience to others. It was only a matter of time before he ditched his law career and opened up Stadtbad in Wedding, a techno club in an abandoned city pool. He says the top electronic musicians in the world played there.
Nina Kravitz, Ben Klock, Len Farke, Sven Feit. Yeah, just name it. People would actually come from all over Europe just to see a certain lineup. They would write us in advance to be like, oh, we're coming for this night. Can we somehow make sure that we get in? And then you just kind of saw what impact this actually has.
But then in 2015, the Stadtbad Club became a casualty of gentrification. The owner of the property decided to sell to a private developer for a huge profit. Stadtbad is now rental apartments. This is happening all over the city. And in fact, there's even a word for it, Clubsterben, which translates as club death. About 100 clubs have closed in Berlin over the past decade, and about 25 more are under threat. And now club owners and supporters are coming together to do something about it. They're advocating for a change in the German building law that would give clubs the same status as opera houses and theaters. Right now, clubs are in the same urban planning category as brothels and casinos. Lutz Leixenring is the spokesperson for the Club Commission, an industry lobby group.
In a club, you're curating your program, you're booking artists, you're going to festivals. So that's much closer to how a theater, for instance, or a concert hall is run.
If the law were changed, it would be a lot easier for new clubs to get zoning licenses. And it would pave the way for more clubs to open, even in residential neighborhoods. Now, if this were happening in New York, where I'm from, I almost guarantee you there would be a large outcry from neighbors. I mean, who wants to live across from a nightclub? It's loud, there are long lines, lots of drug use. But in Berlin, this proposal has widespread support, both from the public and from politicians.
Natürlich bräuchte man eigentlich sowas wie ein Gewerbemietenregelung.
For example, this is Klaus Leder. He's in Berlin government on the Culture Committee, and he's basically arguing that clubs need more protections. It could be that politicians are jumping on the bandwagon because clubs bring millions of euros to the local economy. The Club Commission estimates that 3 million tourists come to Berlin every year for the clubs. But Lutz Leixenring says there's more to it than that.
It's part of the DNA of Berlin that you have this kind of club scene and people talk about it and come from all over the world. Even the startup scene is like advertising with come to Berlin to this vibrant culture. And it's just, it's just defined by it.
And maybe that's why techno fiends and politicians have united under the hashtag Save Our Spaces. Berliners know that giving nightclubs the same status as opera houses won't change everything, like it won't reverse gentrification. But they hope it could lead to a nightclub revival. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
We've got an update on this story. The law passed, but in a watered-down form. Clubs got some, but not all of the protections they were hoping for. But it's not clear if anything can fully save Berlin's club scene.
A week after Sarah's story aired, COVID forced nightclubs and opera houses to close their doors. Berlin's nightlife has still not recovered. According to a new survey by the Club Commission, 46% of Berlin's nightclubs are considering closing down for good in 2025. That's twice the number from the last survey in February.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The holidays are a time to come together with family and friends. It is also when many of us are painfully aware of loved ones who've died, leaving that empty seat at the holiday table. One project is using a very low-tech tool to connect with the departed and create a sacred space for mourning. The World's Bianca Hillier has the story.
In April of 2020, people everywhere were grappling with a new reality. Lockdown. Quarantine. For those grieving the loss of a loved one, the isolation was uniquely intense. In New Jersey, on April 2nd, Amy Dawson lost her 25-year-old daughter, Emily Dawson.
At that time, remember, no one was going anywhere. We couldn't have a service for her. Neighbors didn't stop over. Friends didn't, you know, you're on your own.
Emily passed away not from COVID, but from a prolonged illness. In the weeks following the loss, Dawson searched for ways to connect with her daughter, Emily. That's when she read about wind phones.
A wind phone is a disconnected phone. It is tied to the wind. It is not connected to any phone line.
The phones create space for people to have a one-way conversation with their loved ones who have died.
So you speak into the phone as if you were just speaking to your person. You can say what you need to say. Maybe something you wish you hadn't said and you want to correct the record with them. Maybe you're angry. Maybe you just want to tell them about your day.
The wind, so the idea goes, carries your message. Wind phones are typically rotary phones and are mostly put up in natural environments where users can be uninterrupted and free to express themselves. Dawson believes the tool saved her life after her daughter Emily died, and she's far from alone. Thousands of people have used wind phones since they were created in Japan in 2010. It all started when a man named Itaru Sasaki built a phone booth in his yard so he could connect with a cousin who had recently passed away. Months later, the idea took on an entirely new meaning when the Fukushima earthquake and tsunami hit. Thousands of people died, and Sasaki allowed neighbors to use his wind phone to talk to them. In a documentary by Japan's national broadcaster, NHK, a man speaks into the phone and says, "All four of us are doing the best we can, so don't you worry." Grief, of course, is universal, and the idea spread quickly. There are now more than 300 wind phones around the world. I visit the one closest to me in Dover, Massachusetts. This wind phone is at the base of a really tall tree. There are a few rocks at the base of the tree, so someone could sit down while they're talking. And it's at the end of a dead-end residential street. Peaceful. Private. Dawson thinks that's how it should be.
It's just a beautiful, sacred space for grief to take that moment that you need, settle it somewhere in your heart, and then begin your day again.
Dawson now maintains a map of the world's wind phones online. There's one just outside of Wellington, New Zealand. Mo Blishin put it up outside her home, right by the sea, in 2018.
You should see the place now. It's like a little therapy corner because there's all these stones that people write on and stick on the wall as well. There's a book library that you can go and take books. It's just a nice little space, you know.
Other wind phones are in South Africa, Australia, and across Europe. In Canada, Leah Joy Friesen came across a wind phone while grieving the loss of her son, 16-year-old Mark Audrey Somera, who passed away in 2015.
I dialed my son's number as if he was actually about to receive the phone call. And then I pick it up and I just talk to him and I just release all those emotions. And I strongly believe that the wind carried those messages to him.
Friesen went on to put up a wind phone in Niagara, near where she works. She's a psychotherapist and offers grief support for a living. She still speaks to her son, Mark, via wind phones on holidays and other important days.
Recently, on his death anniversary, I went there and just basically said, you know, it has been 9 years since you're gone and it's difficult, but you wanted me to be strong.
Grief has no timeline, she adds, and it's a good thing wind phones are always operating. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
During this Christmas season, you might have had a thought or two about reindeer. The mythical kind are the ones getting ready for a big journey tonight. The rest have hooves firmly on the ground in the far north, like in Finland. That's where musician Anna Maret lives and where she performs what's known as joiking, an ancient and honestly otherworldly music tradition of the Sami people.
I come from a Sami reindeer herding family, and actually we have a multicultural family because my father belongs to this reindeer herding big family and my mother comes from a Finnish family. So I have been growing up in this, in the border to the both cultures. Of course, that gives a little bit like an ethno-stress that I have been like feeling since my childhood. But doing music and doing joik, it has really like healing me somehow. I have really now got this tight connection to my roots in my father's side in the Sami family. The joiking tradition, that's like a chant that we describe something with the joik, or we remember someone with the joik. So we are not like joiking off somebody, but we are joiking that person as a whole thing. In the tradition, it's actually quite concrete because you can like joik, for example, an animal or a wolf or a place, like for a special mountain, a sacred place. So that's, I think that's quite concrete, and you also have to have a really close relationship to the objective of the duhti, because otherwise you can't describe it. When I make my music, then I like joik the reindeer herding tradition that my ancestors created and made it possible to live in the Arctic area, because reindeer is something that gives us life. We're so connected to the land through the reindeers.
That's musician Anna Maret from her album Dreamscapes.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Buehler.
And I'm Marco Werman, wishing you peace over this holiday season. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.